This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Coming up, Ocean Wave, a new international alliance targeting climate change with the Pacific at the forefront. Former Prime Minister Rick Howe, the big casualty is the fallout from Solomon Islands' diplomatic switch from Taiwan to China goes on. And a dark day indeed for Fiji at the Rugby World Cup on the end of one of the biggest shocks in the tournament's history.
Jesse fights it back. It's a power fan. It's on the board. Uruguay are up. Uruguay are up by 8. We have 5 to go.
The Uruguayans held on. More of that to come later. Good morning. I'm Richard Ewart. First, though, as Pacific leaders in New York for the UN Climate Summit and the General Assembly push for greater action on climate change. The latest report from the UN's Intergovernmental Panel comes with a stark warning. Without urgent cuts to carbon emissions, the scientists say the oceans could turn deadly by the turn of the century. As Penny Timms reports, since the 1970s, the oceans have absorbed 90% of the Earth's excess heat and sucked up huge amounts of carbon dioxide, largely as a result of human-induced pollution.
The IPCC's special report on the ocean and cryosphere in a changing climate is the most definitive look at the world's oceans and frozen areas, and its conclusions are stark. Coe Barrett is a vice chairperson at the IPCC.
The ocean has been acting like a sponge, absorbing carbon dioxide and heat to regulate the temperature, but it can't keep up. These changes show that the world's ocean and cryosphere have been taking the heat for climate change for decades. The consequences for nature and humanity are sweeping and severe.
Co-author Nathan Bindoff is a professor of physical oceanography with the University of Tasmania and the CSIRO, and he says the devastating impacts of climate change are now unavoidable.
We're committed to quite a lot of change in the climate system, regardless of which pathway we take. But the high emissions pathway is definitely much more impactful.
He says even if the world were to reach zero net emissions today, the planet would continue to warm.
The issues are just the pace of change, particularly our oceans and our ice-covered systems.
Professor Mark Haldon is the director of the Australian National University's Climate Change Institute and a vice chairman of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
The long-term implications of that are for many metres of sea level rise. Some of that will be seen in this century, but most of it will be seen in subsequent centuries. And there's very little, once we've started that process, that we can do to stop it. And so all of the emissions we're producing today have multi-century consequences, particularly in terms of sea level rise.
The IPCC report predicts that even in the best-case scenario, the world's oceans will rise by up to 60 centimetres by 2100. It drives home the importance of coastal communities preparing for rising sea levels, especially inundation during extreme weather events, which are expected to happen yearly by 2050 in many places, including Australia. Jo Meneo-Kallio is the head of Pacific for Greenpeace.
It mirrors very much what we're experiencing here, with sea level rise, increasing king tides, storm surges that threaten to wipe out communities and families and livelihoods and access to food and water, but also at a larger level, the threats to our culture and our histories and our stories as a people.
The report aims to assist governments in setting policies to mitigate the worst impacts of climate change, such as the effects already being seen by Pacific Island nations.
The science is clear, and what many leaders are still doing is sacrificing long-term stability and viability of the Pacific for the expediency of short-term economic gain.
The IPCC concludes that while change is inevitable, there is still time to act, and urgently cutting carbon emissions would help to avoid the worst-case scenarios.
That report from Penny Timms. Will the Pacific Island nations continue to pick up the slack left by the big players when it comes to leadership on climate change? With the launch of a new Ocean Wave Alliance, this on the sidelines of the UN Climate Summit in New York. Palau's President Tommy Remengasau Jr. co-hosting the event, where leaders stressed the need for greater financial support for island nations dealing with the worst effects of a changing climate. Pacific Beat reporter Nick Fogarty has been following developments. So, Nick, what agreements or recommendations have come out of this meeting that might help in the fight against climate change?
Well, the key thing for Pacific leaders like Tommy Remengasau Jr. with this alliance seems to be about getting in a room with high-level political and private sector leaders and getting large financial commitments from them. They say it's that money that's needed to build Pacific nations that are more climate resilient, and they also wanted to stress the particular role that oceans and ocean temperatures play in climate change. The event was co-hosted by Norway, Portugal and Kenya, so there's real global reach there. Alisa Williams is in New York reporting for the Pacific Island Forum, and she was at a Commonwealth Secretariat dialogue with ministers, which was also attended by Cook Islands Deputy PM Mark Brown. At that dialogue, he spoke about his country's situation and gave his thoughts on, among other things, Australia's $2 billion Pacific Infrastructure Loan Fund. Here's Lisa's take on his comments.
He's saying that the conditions for loans like that being announced by the developed countries, the conditions need to be freed up and made even more concessional. So he's saying something like repayment timeframes, 50 to 100 years and zero interest rates. He's insisted that that must be the reality moving forward for small island developing states, for the Pacific, in order to cope with the realities that they have not brought on themselves. The countries who are actually going to be giving them the loans must agree to the terms that the Pacific can handle without going broke.
And away from the launch of the Ocean Wave Alliance, Tommy Remengesau spoke about how he was optimistic there's now a blueprint in place for a step up in climate change action.
We've gone beyond just talking about it and describing it and saying it's a crisis or, you know, not so what we need that blueprint. So what happened? And then give that blueprint to our partners, the companies, the foundations, the governments, institutions. Then they say, can you help us to partner with this? And that's what really needs to be.
And Nick, Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison, of course, a notable absentee from the main events of the UN Climate Summit earlier in the week. But I gather he did make a low-key appearance, shall we say, at the Ocean Wave Alliance launch.
Yes, reports are that he entered after the speeches had begun and left before media had a chance to speak to him at the end. But he did speak to Australian media on Tuesday in New York and was asked about a range of issues, including climate change, and especially his response to the youth climate strike movement led by Swedish teenager Greta Thunberg. Here's his response.
You know, I want children growing up in Australia to feel positive about their future. And I think it's important that we give them that confidence that they will not only have a wonderful country and pristine environment to live in, but they'll also have an economy that they can live in as well. And so I think we've got to caution against raising the anxieties of children in our country. Yeah, we've got to deal with the policy issues and we've got to take it seriously. But I don't want our children having anxieties about these issues.
Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison, our reporter there, Nick Fogarty, with assistance from Lisa Williams and Bernadette Carrion from the Pacific Islands Forum reporting team in New York. Now, Australia's Prime Minister has had his chance finally to address world leaders on climate change. This, of course, after he was left off the list of speakers at the UN Climate Summit earlier in the week. His message to the General Assembly on the Pacific came in the form of what is now a familiar catch cry. Australia, he says, is stepping up.
Australia is the single largest development partner for Pacific Island nations. This is an instinctive response for Australia, consistent with our clear national interests and our commitment to our Pacific family, our vovale, our whanau. Our goal is simple, that the Southwest Pacific is secure strategically, stable economically, sovereign politically, and sustainable environmentally. The UN's work in partnership with Australia has also helped to build a more sustainable and resilient Pacific, to support local climate change actions and resilience, to strive for gender equality through the empowerment of women and girls, to support continuing improvement in health outcomes, and to bolster regional peace, including through the Bougainville Referendum Support Project.
Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison addressing the UN General Assembly in New York. You're with Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Hewitt, and we move on to other matters now. On the fallout from Solomon Islands' decision to cut diplomatic ties with Taiwan and line up behind China continues. Former Prime Minister Rick Ho, a vocal supporter of Taiwan, has been booted out of cabinet and the government. On top of that, as Liam Fox reports, one regional premier has gone public to allege he was offered a $1 million bribe by government MPs to support the diplomatic switch.
The political turbulence continues in Solomon Islands following the government's momentous decision to ditch its long-standing ties with Taiwan and formalise diplomatic relations with China. The switch has now claimed a political scalp, with Rick Ho stripped of the planning portfolio. Mr. Ho, a former Prime Minister and Governor of the Central Bank, confirmed to Pacific Beat in a short text message that he was no longer in Cabinet or the government. He told Solomon Business magazine the Prime Minister, Manasseh Sogavare, did not like him being too vocal in Cabinet and caucus. It had previously been reported that Mr. Ho supported maintaining relations with Taiwan and was one of six government ministers who abstained from the recent vote in Cabinet on whether to switch diplomatic ties. Ahead of the sacking, another story connected to the China-Taiwan issue has been dominating the local news headlines. The claim by Malaita Premier Daniel Swidani that government MPs offered him a bribe of $1 million Solomon to support the diplomatic switch. Mr. Swidani told the Solomon Star newspaper,
"There are pro-China MPs within the government who attempted to get the support of Malaita in favour of the diplomatic switch to China, and they promised to offer me money if I made supporting statements in favour of the government's move. I have been promised $1 million to support the China switch. I refuse to accept the offer for the sake of my people and my integrity as a mandated leader."
The two MPs who allegedly offered the bribe have not been named publicly. Opposition leader Matthew Wale has called on the police and Leadership Code Commission to investigate the allegation. In a statement, he said Mr. Sogavare also needs to respond.
"As the alleged bribe was made by two government MPs before the decision to switch diplomatic ties from Taiwan to China was made, it raises the even more serious question of whether the Prime Minister, as head of the government, authorised the two MPs to make the offer to the Premier."
Ruth Lilongula from the corruption watchdog Transparency International backs the call for an investigation. She says she's not surprised by the bribery allegation.
"I believe this is true because in all the things that have happened, the Rush decision and everything else that has happened is as a result of personal benefits to leadership. And this is nothing new in the Solomon Islands."
The Prime Minister's office has released a response to Premier Swidani's bribery allegation. In a statement, the Minister for Provincial Government, Anthony Veke, condemned any form of bribery and he urged the Premier to report the matter to police. A police spokesman told Pacific Beat they're yet to receive a complaint.
Liam Fox reporting, and an update from the Solomon Islands Police saying they have indeed approached Malaita Premier Daniel Swidani and urged him to lodge a formal statement about the bribery allegation, but Mr. Swidani has declined to do so far, according to the police.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Now, researchers working in Papua New Guinea have found that it's members of a local community who are more likely to intervene in incidents of sorcery-related violence rather than police or law enforcement officials. They've also found that a confusing legal framework makes it difficult for victims to face their accusers in court. And as Priyanka Srinivasan reports, now there are calls for the PNG government to provide better funding for anti-sorcery initiatives to strengthen the level of response at both grassroots and state levels.
Communities in Jawaka province in PNG have developed their own unique rules to settle sorcery accusations that all too often lead to torture, vandalism and quite possibly killings. According to Miranda Forsyth from the Australian National University, village courts, made up of community leaders that handle customary issues, have been able to control rumours of witchcraft before they escalate into violence.
Once a person had been accused, then they would go to the police and to the village courts. There would be a mediation, and then the village court would make a preventative order, which would say that the people who had made the accusation would have to sign this order to promise not to make an accusation again. And then all together, they would have a ceremony, they would do awareness raising in that community, and that was a way of trying to ensure the ongoing safety of the person who had been accused as an alternative to prosecution.
Dr. Forsyth is part of a team of researchers looking at ways to improve interventions into sorcery-related violence. They have found community action, like what is taking place in Jawaka, are often the most effective. According to their work, in more than half of all cases, it's village leaders and family members that attempt to stop sorcery accusations from causing violence. And in only 13% of cases do police intervene when accusations first come to light. Fiona Hukula is a senior fellow at the National Research Institute in PNG and a lead researcher in this project.
Well, one of the key things I think that we found from our research is the importance of community leadership to address sorcery accusation. It's the village leaders or community or family members that intervene when there's an accusation, and it's also the same people who attempt to stop violence.
Dr. Hukula says the important role of communities comes as police face significant obstacles in trying to find and control violence.
The criminal justice system faces some significant challenges in dealing with this issue, mainly in terms of the resource constraints and also geographical constraints. It's quite difficult for police to get to some very remote areas. There's also a lack of witness protection, which means that people are reluctant to give evidence to the police.
And there are further challenges when it comes to seeking justice for victims of sorcery accusations. In 2013, following a particularly brutal case of sorcery killings, the government responded by getting rid of the country's Sorcery Act, which had allowed accusations of witchcraft to be used as a defence in murder cases. Miranda Forsyth from ANU says this repeal unintentionally created confusion in what courts could do to fight sorcery-related crimes, and as a result, many of these cases do not make it into the justice system.
There was a lot of confusion as to what exactly does repeal mean. So in the interviews that we've done, a lot of people have talked about a new act called the Repeal of the Sorcery Act. There hasn't been straightforward messaging about what exactly that repeal meant.
And those cases that do go to trial feature male victims, who Dr. Forsyth says have the resources to fight the case.
When we were going through and looking at, well, which cases have actually been prosecuted and got to the stage of a conviction, most of the cases involve male victims. Although men and women are both accused, the impact of accusing a woman is greater. And so women have got less resources that they are able to draw upon in order to fight back.
The researchers are now calling on the PNG government to make good on their earlier promise to provide 3 million kina, over 1 million Australian dollars, to fund a national sorcery action plan. The action plan would help strengthen existing laws and also support grassroots advocacy.
One of the things I think I would like to see from this research is to see some of these community organisations better supported to carry out the very important work that they do in PNG.
The team's final research findings are expected to be presented in PNG in June next year as part of an international conference on sorcery accusation-related violence.
And the reporter there, Priyanka Srinivasan.
Here it is! Here is the moment! Uruguay, incredible! Let's get the party started for the men in blue!
The moment when Fijian hearts sank as Uruguay pulled off one of the biggest shocks in Rugby World Cup history to beat the Flying Fijians by 30 points to 27. It was a game the Pacific Islanders were expected to win at a canter, but in the end, coach John McKee says his players' first half mistakes proved costly against a fired up South American team.
Credit to Uruguay, the way they played this afternoon, and you know the attitude and that they brought to the game. You know they got a great result here today. You know, for us, you know, we were off the pace of the game. You know, critical errors gifted them tries, and you know, we just didn't have the mental toughness to get back into the game.
What did you say to your team at half time?
Oh, look, we thought things were, you know, we'd made some errors. They scored three tries off our errors, basically, and but we hadn't been playing well. You know, we were, you know, focusing on, you know, keeping the ball, not turning the ball over. We, in the first half, we turned the ball over, you know, on the edges too often. And you know, we really believe we could fight our way back into the game.
So how do you recoup as a team?
Well, you know, we've got to get ourselves off the floor now and make sure, you know, we're playing Georgia in 8 days' time. So that's a, you know, massively important game for us.
As for Uruguay, well, you can hear the passion and what the result means to the team in the voice of their captain, Juan Manuel Gamenara.
I'm really proud of my country. We're not the biggest, we're not the tallest, but we came here to win. We are working since we qualified. We are working on this. We never had anything granted. We always have to qualify first and then come to the World Cup. So since we qualified, we're thinking about this game. And you saw the passion.
Certainly did. Quite some achievement for the Uruguayans. Meanwhile, the referees at the Rugby World Cup are under fire from their own side, with World Rugby issuing a damning statement saying that the officials' decision-making hasn't been up to scratch. The referees have responded with a statement of their own and admitted that directives around high tackles in particular may not have been followed closely enough. In particular, there's been controversy around a brutal tackle by Australia's Rhys Hodge in the match against Fiji. The on-field referee took no action at the time, but Hodge was cited and has now been banned for 3 weeks. And two Samoan players who were yellow-carded in their win over Russia are also facing sanctions. Former Manu Samoa World Cup player Earl Var has been watching the tournament in Japan closely, so what does he make of the criticism levelled at the referees by their employers?
Yeah, I don't know who that's, you know, supposed to make happy, whether that's supposed to keep the fans happy, saying that World Rugby, you know, doing everything that they can, and they're not happy with the consistency of the refereeing in the first round. What we don't want, though, is that we don't want refs coming out and blowing every single minute offence up and just slowing the game down and it just becoming a whistle fest. So hopefully, you know, the referees get back together and talk about what went well for them in the first round, what needs to improve, and, you know, they make plans to see those improvements come through.
Do you think it is better to, I guess, err on the side of caution when it comes to head contact in rugby and refereeing? We've seen some unfortunate deaths and injuries in the last few years on rugby fields after head injuries.
Yeah, well, you know, I think, you know, it's a touchy subject. It's, you know, it's a sacred subject to me. You know, I lost a brother playing rugby league when he was only in his early 20s to a head injury. You know, too many concussions and still allowed to go out on the field. So I think everyone's got to be careful. The refs should have, even when Motu Matu'u got yellow carded last night, you know, they sent him off to the bin. They didn't actually tell him that he shouldn't be returning, and you could tell that, you know, he'd had a pretty hefty head knock. So they've got to be a lot more careful, and, you know, they've got the players' welfare to look after, and they've got a duty of care to make sure that the players aren't on the field if they've been through a head injury out on the field.
And on the matter of scheduling, there seems to be a bit of a pattern where the larger nations like Australia get much longer breaks between matches in the World Cup, and small nations, for instance Fiji, have smaller breaks. Do you think that's fair, and is this something where the big nations do get an advantage?
It is an advantage, but I'm not too sure that World Rugby do it on purpose. You know, I don't know who does the scheduling, but you would think that the bigger nations with the stronger squads would be able to handle the short turnaround a lot better than the smaller nations with weaker squads. So maybe they need to do it the other way around and, you know, give Australia a couple of quick games in succession against the minnow nations and then give them their longer breaks when they play in, you know, the bigger games.
Former Manu Samoa World Cup player Earl Var speaking there to Nick Fogarty. And Samoa, at least the one team with a win on the board as far as the Pacific Island nations are concerned at the Rugby World Cup so far. Not going too well for Fiji after that shock defeat by Uruguay. And a word on cricket, because Vanuatu have just set a world record at the World Cup qualifying tournament in Malaysia, beating the host by 13 runs. Nothing remarkable about that at first glance, but Vanuatu were defending a total of just 65 and somehow managed to bowl the Malays out for a remarkable 52. Patrick Matatava, the star all-rounder for the Vanuatu side, taking 5 wickets for just 19 runs. So that's a pretty amazing result. And finally, in another sporting blow for Fiji, their great gold medal hope for the Tokyo Olympics next year, weightlifting prodigy Aileen Thikamatana. She's gone for good. She has become an Australian citizen and been cleared by the International Weightlifting Federation's Executive Board to represent Australia internationally with immediate effect. Just imagine if she goes to Tokyo next year and wins a gold medal, as many think she can. What on earth will they think in Fiji? It's an extraordinary situation and surely have never been allowed to have happened. That's it from Pacific Beats. I'm Richard Ewart. Pacific Mornings is next.